everybody, and welcome to New Books in German Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Craig Sevilla, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Simon Levi-Sulam about his excellent new book, The Italian Executioners, The Genocide of Jews of Italy, published by Princeton in 2018. Simon, hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you. Simon, we traditionally like to begin these interviews by having the author tell us something about themselves.
Well, I am a professor at the University of Venice, Ca' Foscari, in Italy. I work on modern European history, especially Italian and French in the 19th and 20th century. But I like to remember that I've had an extensive U.S. Academic training, and part of my career happened on the East and West Coast in the States. So I have a special connection to your country.
Wonderful. Where did you study in the United States?
I was at Berkeley and UCLA, and I spent some time at Columbia, the Italian Academy. So I remain attached to that world. And then I went on to an experience at Oxford. But my research has led me, especially in Italy, in France, in archives and libraries. And now I teach in modern Europe in Italy, in Venice especially.
What was your dissertation?
I worked on Mazzini, the Italy's father founder in the 19th century, and I tried to claim that despite the fact that he's usually considered a liberal, there were authoritarian elements in his thought, which were then used in the 20th century in the making of fascist ideology. And this was quite controversial, but I published it as a book in Italian first in 2010, and then in the book came out also in the UK and the US with Palgrave Macmillan, more recently in 15, under the title Giuseppe Mazzini and the Origins of Fascism. And so I tend to be a revisionist as regarding Italian history. I like to study the dark side of Italian history, a country that is usually known for its beauties and its monumental past and the Renaissance, Dante Alighieri, etc. I think we have to concentrate also on its more complex and dark moments.
That's a great transition into your current book. So how did you get the idea to write this book? Was it something you've been thinking about for a long time? Did it come out of your dissertation, your last book?
Well, I had worked on the last phase of fascism at the very beginning of my career. With my first article was devoted to the Republic of the Salo Republic, which was this puppet republic created by Mussolini and with the Nazi support in the heart of the Second World War, between 1943 and 1945. But I didn't deal specifically with the Jewish question and the Holocaust then. However, in recent years, I've been increasingly preoccupied with the fact that the Italian public opinion and also the Italian academia, but especially the international academia outside Italy, has not dealt so much with the criminal aspect of fascism. Oftentimes, fascism is seen as the lesser evil comparison to Germany, and I wanted to show and to focus on, for that reason, on the most violent, the most criminal phase of fascism, which had been a dictatorship at least since 1925 in Italy, and had been a violent dictatorship, not only persecuting public, political opinion, but also persecuting anti-fascist workers, socialists, etc., oftentimes killing them. But I wanted to look at a more recent phase, the phase at the heart of the Second World War, in which during the German occupation, Mussolini returned to power and enhanced its anti-Jewish persecution. We will probably mention the fact that in 1938, Mussolini introduced racial laws in Italy, anti-Jewish laws, expelling Jews from Italian society. And this was a preliminary phase to a more radical phase, which took place during the Second World War, which marked the transition from the persecution of the rights of Jews, which had been kicked out from Italian society, schools, universities, libraries, jobs, to the persecutions of the life of the Jews, when Jews were actually hunted down in around Italy, especially in the center north of Italy, during the war, and were first confined in detention camps, and then turned to the Germans, and this was basically the Italian chapter of the so-called Final Solution. The Germans would then would ship them then to, well, Eastern Europe, especially Auschwitz, where they were killed in the thousands in concentration camps. So there was a political and scientific preoccupation with the criminal nature of fascism. And then there was also my personal involvement. I have a Jewish background, and part of my family was killed in the Holocaust. So I don't deny, and I am interested in exploring the scholars' implication in the topic he or she works on as a kind of a personal trigger.
Sure. Good. I think this is a good place to sort of talk about the central problem that you're dealing with in your book, that both in historiography and in public perception, the Italians have often been viewed as not willingly or actively participating in the genocide of Italian Jews. And in a lot of cases, it's gone even further than that, that, you know, you mentioned in your book about the number of places in Italy that study resistance to fascism, and very few that study actually participating in fascism. I wonder if you could talk about that myth, where it comes from, why it's persisted, and then we'll get into some more specific things, but I think it'd be good to talk about the big historiographical problem that you're dealing with.
Yes, well, both in the historiography of the Holocaust, especially at the international level, since the classic historiography of the Holocaust started, for example, in the major work by Raoul Hilberg, The Destruction of European Jews, published in the early 60s, which then became a classic and is still used in the historiography of the Holocaust, and in other major classic works on totalitarianism, for example, Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism, published in 1951, the role of Italy and the space devoted to Italy in the Holocaust is very limited. Also, French historiography, which was pioneering in the field, for example, Leon Poliakov, the Russian scholar who worked in France and a major specialist of anti-Semitism and one of the first authors of a major monograph on the Holocaust in Europe. In these works, the role of Italy is very limited. The role of Italian executioners is very limited. Italy is painted as a heaven for the rescue of European Jews fleeing from Eastern and Central Europe, the Italians are represented as a benevolent people who open their home and with the Catholic clergy playing a major role in rescuing Jews, for example, in convents during the war. This was the result of limited knowledge about the Italian experience, about the Italian experience of fascism more generally. For example, Hannah Arendt even denies that fascism can be considered a totalitarianism in her classic work, The Origins, which I mentioned. Well, actually, the word totalitarianism itself was created by Italians, first by the anti-fascists who used it as a, of course, as a critique of fascists, the anti-democratic ruling, and then it was picked up by the fascists themselves, who liked the term and adopted to define themselves. But it wasn't only a question of distance from the sources and of limited knowledge. We now know from several works that there was an active role, for example, of Italian diplomacy right after the war in denying the role of a violent role of, for example, the Italian army in the Balkans, where Italian fascists had played an active role in so-called anti-partisan warfare while they sided with the Germans in the first half of the Second World War. Or there was, more generally, for example, a denial of colonial crimes in Ethiopia, in which Italy had, the country, been involved since the mid-30s, when it created an Italian empire during the peak of consent of fascism at the heart of Italian imperialism. And also the role of Italians in the Holocaust had been limited, had been denied and basically hidden by Italian diplomacy, by the Italian army, and by Italian society at large. The problem was hiding or not dealing with the Italian involvement, or the involvement of the Italian people with fascism. The fact that Italians had sided with fascism for basically two decades, had offered their consent to the regime, and most of Italian society had been fascist. And another element which contributed to this erasure of Italian responsibilities in the Holocaust was the fact that in 1946 an amnesty of fascist crimes was enforced, which basically erased all major fascist responsibilities, both during the regime and during the Second World War. So very few post-war trials were celebrated, and very few people were condemned based on for these crimes. So these factors contributed to a very benevolent image of Italy outside Italy, through the role of classics, major historiographical works, and even to an active role of Italian institutions and Italian society at large.
I definitely want to ask you about trials, but before I do, I just wanted to follow up by asking, do you think that the Allies, particularly the Americans, had anything to do with this sort of massaging over the Italian fascist past, because they wanted the Italians to switch sides, they wanted to welcome them back into the community of nations after the war, they had enough problems to deal with the Germans?
I think they wanted. Italy had shifted alliances in the course of the war and had decided to side with the Allies. And in response to this, the U.S. and other Western countries, in a sense, adopted Italy and decided that it would belong to the Western bastion in the Cold War divide. There was also the concern that Italy could turn into a communist country because of the growing influence of the Communist Party in the country. So counting on watering down the past responsibility was seen as necessary and perhaps essential to obtain Italian support of the Western alliance in the Cold War, and this would help both the U.S. in acting against Nazi Germany and its crimes, and in separating Italy from the growing influence of the USSR.
So trials, you do mention a number of times in the book about the amnesty law, but you do talk about a couple of the trials that took place. I'm wondering if you can explain the sort of the characteristics of those trials, how they operated, did they borrow from Nuremberg, for instance, and how were they perceived?
Well, to begin with, there was never a Nuremberg for Italian fascist crimes. The entire focus of the Western countries was on Nazi Germany, and locally or nationally in Italy, very few trials were celebrated following the war. Before the amnesty of 1946, which was actually enforced by and decided by the secretary of the Communist Party, Palmiro Togliatti, who was also the Minister of Justice. And this was done to avoid basically a civil war in Italy because of the fact that, or to close the civil war. The resistance movement had involved only several thousand Italians, but basically had split Italy between fascists and anti-fascists. But the majority of Italians had been fascists. So if there had been no amnesty, most of Italians would have been in jail, probably. So as if today the absence of an Italian Nuremberg seems sounds shocking, probably at the time it was necessary on the political grounds to avoid a huge split in Italian society, the continuation of violence, and the fact that most Italians would have been called to explain their position and to pay for what they had done, basically supporting fascism. So a few trials took place, but as in Nuremberg, the anti-Jewish crimes were not a specific accusation, were not legally acknowledged yet by international law nor by national laws. So the specific anti-Jewish activity since 1938, and specifically in the Holocaust, the role of Italians in arrest, the depredation of wealth, and the turning in Jews to the Germans or betraying them was never considered as a specific crime in Italian courts. As it is known that this was true also for Nuremberg, and the crime against the Jewish people was crimes against the Jewish people were acknowledged only later on internationally, starting with the Eichmann trial in 1961 in Israel. This was done by Israeli law, so it didn't exist in Italy as it hasn't existed in Nuremberg, where the Holocaust itself has not been a specific object of discussion. The same was true in Italy, even more so in a sense. Only a few war criminals were brought to justice, but there was no mention of the role in the Holocaust. And those who served in jail at the higher rank were soon released in the early 50s through other amnesties, or were able to flee the country. For example, General Roatta, who had been active in the Balkans and who had been responsible for extreme violence in the Balkans. Some trials did take into consideration or mentioned in passing the role that, for example, a few policemen, the head of police had in, for example, in Rome, in the arrest of Jews. But usually this was overturned, and the police was often able to show that in several other cases they had tried to help Jews. And in fact, the police is another institution, the Italian police, including the military police, the Carabinieri, who were at the head of the arrest of Jews during the war, were very active in constructing a very positive image of themselves after the war, and in portraying themselves as victims of the Germans and not as independent actors on the Italian scene. And to this day, the Carabinieri, the Italian military police, a major police force in Italy, has denies access to its archives, historical archives. So the role of the Carabinieri in the arrest is known, but has not been documented on their own papers. It emerges, however, in police records and in other official papers, so it is proved. But these trials never brought to the attention of the judges the anti-Jewish activity. And in fact, both the police and the judges were left untouched by the transition to post-fascism, meaning the judges and the persecutors who were active and had trained during fascism, and the policemen who had been trained and were active during fascism, remain largely the same, did not change after the war and in post-fascist Italy. It was the same men. And in fact, there were incredible cases in which individual policemen who had been in charge of stealing the Jewish, confiscating Jewish wealth, were then made responsible after the war of the restitution of Jewish wealth, because they were the experts and specialists of the field. Basically, there was after the liberation, the next days, most of Italian policemen were declared innocent and were put in charge of the restitution of Jewish wealth as if nothing had happened.
When I got to that section of your book, I was shocked by that. So in essence, there was no, unlike in Germany where there was a whole denazification process, that just did not happen in Italy at any level of government.
Basically not. Yes. There were cases of people who had turned in their friends and informants. That was basically not the object of attention by the Italian justice. And the amnesty of 1946 had a major role. And the fact that the Italians wanted to call themselves anti-fascist after the fall of the regime, which had brought them to a disastrous war, there was basically a general complicity of Italian society in declaring Italy innocent and, in a sense, turning Italy into a victim of Nazism and of fascism, which, in truth, it had largely supported.
I get the sense from your answer that Italian, ordinary Italians, citizens on the street, people reading newspapers, by and large, would have been very against these trials.
There was a fear that, because of the large involvement of Italians at all levels in fascist bureaucracy, and the fact that fascism controlled the Italian society through the regime, its various associations, youth association, school programs, etc. This involvement, the Italian involvement in fascism, was so deep that basically all Italy would have been put under trial if the amnesty would not have been enforced. So certainly, this was seen as something dangerous and something that would have damaged the civil texture of Italian society, which was in desire of peace and returning to democracy, and also the fact that Christian democracy, which in many ways became a heir to the role of the fascist party, Italy was actually split between the Communist Party and the Christian Democrats after the war. But they made an alliance in erasing fascist crimes and involvement within fascism.
And that's a different experience, particularly with the communists who, in other countries, in Germany or in France or in East Germany, really wanted to highlight fascist crimes. Is that something you thought about, that it's very different in Italy, that the communists and the Christian Democrats would make that sort of deal?
Yes, well, the problem is that the communists themselves have been largely involved. I mean, the leadership of the party had been in exile. For example, Togliatti himself, the secretary of the party, had been in exile in Moscow, and so had no involvement with fascism. Other had been in France, other had been in jail or killed, but you could count anti-fascists in very small numbers. So if you were to put under trial all the communist electorate, you would be dealing with a large involvement also of that electorate, which had, in a sense, discovered democracy only after the war, but had largely supported fascism before the war. So it was, in a sense, a necessary political move. The involvement, the degree of involvement, I mean, only Italy and Germany can be compared on those grounds because, for example, you mentioned France, but France did not have a fascist government apart from Vichy, which was a short parenthesis in the course of the war. So there weren't, large spread support. There wasn't a spread, widespread support for two decades of a fascist regime in France. The German case is totally different also because Germany, as you know, was occupied, was split, and so it's in a sense quite hard to compare to the Italian case.
Okay, good. So I want to move to something else. You spend a lot of time in your book talking about individual motivations for why they participated. And of course, it's not possible to get inside every individual's head or even groups of individuals. But I do want you to spend some time talking about the particular things that motivated Italians to participate in genocide, and particularly the looting of Jewish property, which you talk about in this book a lot. So I'll let you do that.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it is important to underline that a limited number of Italians most likely were motivated by anti-Semitism itself in the persecution of the Jews. I mean, the ideological factor was a limited factor in motivating persecution. I claim that Italian participation should be put in the context of the Italian Civil War, the split between fascists and anti-fascists, and the war and the German occupation. So under special condition of distress for Italian society, in which Italians, in a sense, were all one against the other, in which there was a great climate of suspicion, of self-defense, lots of selfishness, which also was the result of the heavy conditions of the war. So the motivating factor was sometimes self-defense, sometimes you mentioned the looting of Jewish property, oftentimes it was the search for enrichment. So you would denounce a Jew, so you could, for example, your Jewish neighbor, so you could hopefully move into their apartment and perhaps take his wealth. Sometimes it had been your the partner in the common enterprise, in a common a business party. Sometimes it was your neighbor, sometimes somebody who lived down the street. also the notion of genocide is very relevant, because I tried to show, and I can say I've been one of the first to use this notion, also to avoid the centrality of the ideological factor. Because if you talk about the Holocaust, it's obviously a project of annihilation of the Jewish people. When you talk of genocide, more factors are implied. General violence against your neighbor for self-defense, for the desire of enrichment, and, for example, for, in a sense, sometimes there were past episodes which had split people who knew each other, and it was returning on those problems in common businesses or things that hadn't worked out in a friendship would result in betrayal. Also, genocide as it is seen today, and especially the genocide of the Jews of Europe, as it has been described by, for example, Raoul Hilberg or Zygmunt Bauman, is a process which has involved a lot of bureaucratization. And so thousands of Italians were involved in the genocide of the Jews only through a limited segment of this tragedy, meaning they played a bureaucratic role, for example, in drafting the list of Jews that would be arrested, or in listing the wealth that would be confiscated, or in driving the truck that would lead a Jewish family from their address, the private address, to a detention camp. This allowed a large participation and support, because all these functions were fragmented, and basically, as Raoul Hilberg and Zygmunt Bauman have written, only a few people had an active role in killing Jews face to face, in Operation Barbarossa or in the extermination camps. Very few were those who pushed the Jews physically into the gas chambers or poured gas in the chambers. The Holocaust took place as a genocide through a huge machinery of destruction in which bureaucracy played a huge role. And this is how this is what happened also in Italy. So participation was also the call of duty, the call of process of bureaucratization, the call of collaboration, peer pressure. Some of the things written by Christopher Browning in Ordinary Men, where he studied violence on the Eastern Front and the involvement of regular ordinary policemen, apply also to the Italian case. It wasn't a killing on the case of killing on the Italian soil, but the peer pressure for example, in the arrest by policemen, was a factor involved. So there were many factors. There were motivations which had to do with enrichment, with hate, personal hate, not ideologically or racially motivated. There was an ideological commitment too, because we know there were voluntary of the fascist party reconstituted under Mussolini in 1943 during the German occupation. And there was anti-Semitic prejudice, a kind of fatalism towards the Jews. And this is also another page which has been overlooked internationally, sometimes also by Italian historiography, the role played by anti-Semitism, also in modern Italian history. Italians were not free from anti-Semitic prejudice. In fact, the Catholic background had built through centuries many prejudices and hostility, which then constituted a substratum to persecution, and on which fascism had built a propaganda and an ideological campaign, at least since 1938, where, as I mentioned, they did enforce racial laws.
I think this is an important thing to emphasize. The character of Italian anti-Semitism is really very different than Nazi anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. correct? That, you know, the Nazi anti-Semitism is more pseudo-scientific, you know, racial-based, right. whereas Italian anti-Semitism has a more deep religious undertone, yes. Catholic undertone.
Yeah, but yes, this is true in terms of its origins, and we cannot say that, for example, anti-Semitism played a major role within Italian nationalist ideology when Italy was formed in the 19th century. We see few instances of anti-Semitism among Italian nationalist thinkers in the 19th century, for example, Mazzini, whom I mentioned, or others. Probably there was a more spread anti-Judaism, which is the theological version, Christian and specifically Catholic version of anti-Jewish hatred spread by the Catholic Church. Still in the late 19th century, there were there was a resurgence of anti-Jewish hostility by the Catholic Church in the 19th century because, as we know, the Vatican was the object of an attack by the Italian nationalists who formed the Italian state and basically secluded the church within the walls of the Vatican. We should remember that until the 1860s, the Vatican had a full-fledged state in central Italy, while its political role was then limited to the city of Rome and to a neighborhood of the city of Rome. And I don't mention, of course, the spiritual influence, which remains very relevant today, of the Catholic Church, I mean. But politically, the church was a loser in the 19th century, and also because of the advancement of secular ideology, socialism, positivism, etc. And as a reaction, it often pointed to Jews as a symbol of modernity, that modernity which had persecuted the church and had once again limited its political and in part also spiritual role. So there were anti-Jewish campaigns led by the church. For example, it's an official mouthpiece, Civiltà Cattolica, the Jesuit periodical, which still is in printing in the 1880s and 1890s. And there was spread anti-Jewish prejudice. And we cannot forget that the Catholic Church has given up anti-Semitism as an official position, an official view of the church, only in the early 60s, so several years after the wars and after the Holocaust, over 15 years after the Holocaust, only with the Second Vatican Council. At the same time, there's been a wealth of historiography in the last 20 years in Italy, which has shown that also the Italian sciences participated in racism, and that racism had a role especially in building Italian colonialism. Since the 1880s, Italy tried to start an empire in Africa or to acquire conquest colonies, first in Ethiopia, later in Libya, which it conquered in 1911-1912, and then finally with the conquest of most of Ethiopia and the declaration of an Italian empire in Ethiopia in 1935, this colonial enterprise to which Italy participated in the scramble for Africa required the support of Italian sciences. So the existence of an Italian race was declared also by Italian sciences. And after all, race was a spread category in European thought, in the sciences and literature, since at least the mid 19th century throughout Europe, and Italy was not exempt from this. What we must say is, yes, fascism did not have anti-Semitism at its core, at its when it started in the 20s, although there has been work, for example, Mussolini trying to show that he had lots of ambivalence towards the Jews, and there are anti-Jewish statements by Mussolini already in the 20s, and there are important episodes at the end of the 20s and in the early 30s in which there is some indication of anti-Semitism within the fascist party. And there were dreams of the fascist party which used anti-Semitism, for example, the so-called economic anti-Semitism. For example, Farinacci, who was one of the secretary of the fascist party in 25, in the 30s attacked Jewish capitalism openly. And in the mid-30s, also the anti-fascists were accused of being largely Jewish. There was an important Jewish segment among anti-fascism, but there were open generalization by fascism. And then there was a connection between the racial question and the Jewish question, which started already in 37, right after the declaration of the Italian Empire in Ethiopia. The first racial laws enforced by the fascist regime were actually laws enforced in the colonies, where the mixed breed sexual relationships between African women and Italian men were forbidden by law in 1937. Then came in 1938 the racial laws, anti-Semitic racial laws, which were in fact a shift, a major turning point in the policies and also on the ideological level for fascism.
So let's shift gears. I think that was very fascinating. So thank you for explaining all of that. To rescue. You don't talk a lot about it in your book, but you do say it happens. It's not as certainly not as widespread as we had believed. But if you can talk about the character of rescue, who participated, what you think, how widespread do you think it was?
Rescue did play an important role in the Italian experience. My book is concerned with genocide. I don't do a full treatment of, you know, the destiny and the experience of the Jews of Italy during the war, or of European Jews who found themselves in Italy during the war and during the Holocaust. Otherwise, I would have had to devote a relevant attention to rescue, which was an important, very relevant aspect. And I can say, from my own family experience, if I can mention the scholar's background once again, that part of my family on my father's side was deported, and part of my father's family was saved by Italians. And in fact, if I am here today, I owe this to other Italians who rescued, especially my father's family. So I am myself, in a sense, a demonstration of the fact that Italians deported Jews, arrested Jews, and part of my family was deported and killed, including small children. Another part of it was saved. A major role was played by the Catholic clergy. So as we mentioned, ideological commitment against the Jews, we should also mention the role of the Catholic clergy in and the Catholic Church in rescuing Jews. It was done based on Catholic principles of, you know, rescuing lives. This did not necessarily entail getting rid of anti-Semitic prejudice, but in front of a life under threat, convents opened their doors, especially in Rome. Tens of convents hosted for several months Jews in hiding. It is also true that there was no central order from the high echelons of the Catholic clergy for the rescue. The question of the silences of Pius XII, the Pope of the time, is still open. no document has been found that the fact that the Roman convent opened their door was decided from high above. And the Holocaust did take place under the windows of the arrest of Jews in Rome in October 1943, especially with no statement, with no condemnation by the Pope. But apart from the clergy, individual Italian helped Jews in the countryside, in cities. Sometimes they did it out of an act of generosity. Sometimes they received payment for that. And they showed that several thousand Jews were rescued. And so they put their life under under threat. Many, many Italian did so. What I emphasize in the book is that in recent years, in the last decade or so, probably the last 15 years, there's been an increasing and unbalanced attention on the rescue of Jews by Italians in Italian society. For example, Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem, has acknowledged hundreds of Italians rescuing Jews, but it has paid very limited attention to Italian executioners, to Italian participating in the Holocaust. So on Holocaust Remembrance Day, which was established in the year 2000, also in Italy, a European-wide date which coincides with the date of the opening of the gates of Auschwitz on January 27, 1945, every year there are Italians who are acknowledged as having saved Jews, but very limited attention is paid to the role of Italians who arrested Jews. I think we should find, certainly on historical ground, a balance between acknowledging rescue and acknowledging the role in the deportations. Otherwise, seen from the perspective of the public debate, even in Italy, we always talk of Italians who saved Jews, and we cannot understand how was it possible that almost 7,000 Jews were arrested and deported and killed.
Yeah, so that leads me to my next question. How do you see the perception of Italy's role in the Holocaust changing in the future? You know, as younger generations of Italians become historians and look into these questions. And how was your book received in Italy?
I think Italian historiography is increasingly dealing with these problems, the criminal nature of fascism and also the Italian involvement in the Holocaust. And in fact, my book comes in Italy as a synthesis of work that has been done in the last 15 to 20 years and perhaps even more by many younger scholars on whose work I have based part of my own work, work that's been done on individual cities, for example, Florence or Venice or Milan or even Rome, has increasingly acknowledged and reconstructed in detail the role of Italians in the Holocaust and also more generally the criminal nature of fascism. And I think this is emerging also in international historiography, especially in the US. And I think that a new generation of scholars trained by Italian specialists like Victoria De Grazia at Columbia University or Ruth Ben-Diaz at NYU or in other American campuses, they themselves have worked on these topics in part, or they are training a new generation of scholars who have looked at the violent nature of fascism. And also, there's other work that's been translated into English on Italian antisemitism during fascism. For example, I have to recall Michele Sarfatti's work published by Wisconsin University Press in the George Mosse collection already a decade ago, because Sarfatti is one of the leading scholars of fascist antisemitism, and he has headed the Center for Jewish History in Milan for several decades, and his work was published in the States already about a decade ago. So new work is now available, and I think this enterprise of balancing the historical record will continue. In general, the Italian edition of my book has sold very well, but apart from the commercial aspect, I think many Italians are grateful that the historical record is being restored. Generally, newspaper articles were quite favorable. There is still some resistance within academic circle in when you talk of the Italian executioner, and there's the perception that I want to try to establish a parallel with the German experience, which I want only in part, because as a historian, I think comparison is necessary and is useful to establish what is specific of every national experience and what is so, especially to work on differences more than on similarities. This is still regarded with some uncertainty and with some skepticism in Italian academic circles. But I think that historical truth will proceed. And I don't want to be moralistic about it. I think even in my book, I didn't want to draw a list of Italians who arrested Jews or participated in the Holocaust, but I was more interested in describing the process of involvement in violent actions and also the bureaucratization of violence, which made possible what happened. Many Italians were ordinary Italians who did not perform violent duties. They participated in the process of persecution. And this is the answer I often give to the question that is often raised, that did Italians who participated in these actions, especially bureaucratic actions, know what they were doing, meaning what would be the ultimate result of what they were doing, how spread were the news of the final solution and of the terminal aim and conclusion, meaning extermination in the gas chambers, known in Italy. The news were known, certainly the Vatican news, many the elite knew. We have diaries from intellectuals who were well informed, not only by journalism but also through diplomatic connections, that knew what was happening in Eastern Europe. What I say, probably the population at large did not have a clear notion of what was happening. That's most likely true, but what they did know is that they were participating in a process of persecution of some sort, a process which had started in 1938 with the expulsion of Jews from Italian society, with the creation of a kind of an apartheid system, Jewish schools for Jews only, no Jewish books lent in Italian libraries, no Jewish companies, no Jewish partnerships within, and for example, Jewish professionals working only for a Jewish population. So a system of apartheid, which had been built and kept alive by fascism for 5 years, then was, in a sense, enhanced, and a new radical policy was started in the name of of a renewed alliance with Nazism that resulted in Holocaust. So the population that participated in this project knew that it was participating in a process of persecution. Very, very clearly, they knew what they were doing. If they did not know of the fatal results and the fatal end of that process, they knew that they weren't that they were involved in a process based on hostility, of prejudice, and on state persecution. I think this will emerge more and more from the sources. Also, now there are no privacy limits on the official sources on this experience in state archives in Italy. So there's free open access to these documents, and I think historians will increasingly write on this and works will be translated on this that will spread the knowledge of what was the Holocaust, not only in the heart of Europe, in Germany or in Eastern Europe, but also in Western Europe, and the notion that the Holocaust could not take place without collaborationists throughout Europe, including the Italian collaborationists, and in this case actually allies, will basically be clearly established and reinforced.
So we're coming in close to an hour, so let me ask, what are one or two things that you would like somebody listening or someone who's reading your book to take away from your book? You could, you know, force them to two things, one or two things.
Yeah, well, I think, as I mentioned at the very beginning, I hope this book will, by focusing on the most extreme and most violent phase of Italian history, of Italian fascism, will allow a reconsideration of the fascist experience more generally and once again of its criminal nature. The fact that fascism already in the 20s was in the mid 20s became a dictatorship and a violent one, which persecuted the opposition and limited freedom and denied the freedom of opinion, freedom of press, freedom of political association, but also killed its opponents. I can recall the Rosselli brothers, prominent anti-fascists, which were killed in France in 1937. I can recall the name of Antonio Gramsci, now acknowledged as a leading philosopher throughout the world for his theoretical work, but actually the major anti-fascist fighter who died as a consequence of his jailing in fascist prisons in 1937. But others were killed already in 1924, like Matteotti, and or in 25, like Piero Gobetti, who died in exile. So this is one aspect which I think the readers of my book internationally will be brought to reconsider, led to reconsider. Another aspect is how to study the spread of violence in genocide and civil war, and especially in genocide. The idea that genocide studies are increasingly showing is that genocide does not take place in faraway lands. We often associate genocide with something, in a sense, exotic or even oriental. Well, for example, Rwanda or Armenia or Cambodia. Well, we know from recent experiences in the 1990s that it can happen also in the heart of Europe, Bosnia. We know this from the Second World War. Genocide is the killing of the next door neighbors. Once there are the ideological and social and cultural preconditions to persecute the other, your next door neighbors. So I am interested, and I hope the readers will be interested in reading about and trying to understand how those violence spread at the molecular level once there are the conditions which are enforced by hatred of your next door neighbors, by racism, prejudice, hostility, in a special condition of war or of extreme socioeconomic and political tensions. These are perhaps two major aspects, one more specific, the Italian experience, and the other sort of more broad, which Italy in 1943-45, the heart of the European experience, becomes a study case, the question of genocide.
Well, yeah, no, thank you for that. I want to encourage everybody listening to go out and get the book. It's a great book. It's also very concise, at about 150 pages. So definitely enjoyed reading the book. But before I let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot and sort of ask you, what are you working on now?
I have two projects. One deals with one of the sources of the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a early 20th century forgery, probably drafted in Russia with strong French influence, which describes a text which describes a world conspiracy by Jews to conquer the control of the world, of world economics, and of society at large. This forgery is still spread. It had enjoyed a huge success after the First World War, but it's still spread online, and it's often the subtext of fake news attacking Jews for their wealth and their supposed access to the control of society and economics. And I am working on a specific source, a text of the 1870s by an Englishman who traveled through the Mediterranean in Europe and wrote in 1873 a book called The Conquest of the World by Jews. And this short text, which is one of the first anti-Jewish polemic of the modern period, becomes one of the sources of the forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Another broader project has to do with, again, Italian history, and it's about the role played by Italian intellectuals in the transition from fascism to anti-fascism, and how Italian intellectuals who were, as most of Italian society, largely involved in fascism, then described themselves after the war as largely anti-fascist, and how they helped Italian society build a narrative which was largely based on the oblivion of fascist crimes and the oblivion of Italian responsibility within fascism. So I looked at a few major intellectual novelists, journalists, and academics who had been involved in fascism and then sort of self-fashioned themselves as openly anti-fascist after the war and helped build a collective narrative of in the post-war period in which the responsibility, the Italian responsibility within fascism were basically erased. These are my two projects.
Well, they both sound fascinating, and when you finish and they become books, I hope you'll be back on the show to talk about them. I want to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed talking to you about this book. I also want to thank everybody for listening to New Books in German Studies, and we will see you all next time.